Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 5, Discourse Number 4.
The first question. Bhagwan, when I am dead, am I really dead? I want to be really convinced that death is eternal sleep. Ram Jethmalani, death is the greatest illusion. It has never happened. It can't happen in the very nature of things. Yes, there is something which creates the illusion. Death is a disconnection between the body and the soul. But only a disconnection. Neither the body dies nor the soul. The body cannot die because it is already dead. It belongs to the world of matter. How a dead thing can die? And the soul cannot die because it belongs to the world of eternity, to God. It is life itself. How life can die? In us, both are together. This connection becomes disconnected. The soul becomes unplugged to the body. That's all what we call is death. The body moves back to the matter, to the earth. And the soul, if it has still desires, longings, starts seeking another womb, another opportunity to fulfill them. Or if the soul is finished with all the desires, with all the longings, then there is no more any possibility of it coming back into a bodily form. Then it moves into eternal consciousness. Moving into eternal consciousness is a very paradoxical phenomenon. One is not, and yet one is. A dewdrop is slipping into the ocean. Innocence is no more. As a dewdrop, it is no more. The boundary that made it a dewdrop has disappeared. But in another sense, it is more than it has ever been. It has become the very ocean. The boundary has expanded to infinity. The boundary has exploded into the unbounded. A man like Buddha becomes the universal consciousness. Yet, and this is the paradox, His individuality is not lost. His consciousness is not lost. So Ram, I cannot say that death is eternal sleep. On the contrary, it is eternal awakening. Poets have been telling you down the ages that death is eternal sleep, don't be afraid. They themselves know not. They are simply giving you consolation. But what can be the difference between real death and eternal sleep? Have you ever thought about it? If the sleep is eternal, it is death. If it is never going to be broken, then where is the difference? A corpse and an eternally asleep man are exactly the same. If the sleep is going to be forever and forever, it is death. The primitive people are far more closer to the truth. They say that sleep is a small death. They are right. Because for a few hours, you become completely oblivious of the world, of others, of yourself, of your body. You become completely disconnected for a few hours, then you are reconnected again. It is a small death. Sleep is a small death, but not vice versa. Death is not eternal sleep. If it is, then what will be the difference, Ram? If you simply want to console yourself that I will be eternally asleep in death, that's another matter. But truth is not to console you. Truth is as it is. The truth is that death has two possibilities. If you die with longing, desiring, then it brings you back into another body. Because without body, you cannot make any effort to fulfill your desires. Without the body, you cannot eat food. You cannot make love. Without the body, you cannot become the prime minister of a country. Without the body, it is impossible to do anything. Body is the vehicle of doing things, gaining, journeying, reaching, arriving. Without the body, you simply are. It is a state of being. With the body, you are always becoming. Becoming this, becoming that, richer, more famous, more successful. Without the body, all becoming ceases. Becoming is another name of desiring. So if a person dies with the deep, deep desire to become something, he will be born again into another body. That is one alternative. The second is, if you have understood the futility of desire, the utter stupidity of desire, if you have seen through and through that no desire can ever be fulfilled, that it promises, and it promises greatly, but it never delivers the goods, that all desires are deceptive, that it is because of our unintelligence that we go on being victims of desires. If you have seen it through and through, and you die with no projection in the mind, with no seed of desire, all seeds are burnt. It is because of this Patanjali has called the ultimate state of samadhi Nirbij Samadhi, seedless samadhi. If you can die with all the seeds burnt, there will be no more any sprout. There will be no more another birth. Then where do you go? You don't fall asleep. In fact, to attain to a state of seedless samadhi, one has to be absolutely awake. One has to be a Buddha. Because the seeds of desire are burnt only in the fire of awakening. So if you die without any desire, you die in utter awareness. You see death happening. And remember again, by death I mean you see the disconnection happening. Slowly, slowly, the soul is becoming separate from the body. Slowly, slowly, it is becoming uprooted from the body. It is becoming freer from the prison. And one moment comes when you are totally free from the prison, outside the prison cell called body-mind mechanism. Then you remain eternally awake. Then you remain in the universe, diffused in the ocean of life, but eternally awake. It is not a state of sleep. You ask me, when I am dead, am I really dead? Ram Jethmalani, the real you will not be dead, but Ram Jethmalani is going to be dead. Because Ram Jethmalani is nothing but the name of the combination of soul and body. It is the name of the identity. We feel identified with our bodies. We think we are our bodies, our minds. Remember, mind is only a part of the body, the subtle part, the invisible part. If we are identified with body-mind mechanism, then certainly this identification is going to die. Ram Jethmalani is bound to die. But there is something in Ram Jethmalani which is not going to die. You have to become aware of it. And the only way to become aware of it is to be more meditative, to be more of a witness. Start watching your body. Start watching your mind. Don't get involved. Remain aloof, distant, cool. Just as one sits on the bank of a river and watches the river flow by, you don't say, "I am the river." So is the body. Watch it. Become more and more of a witness. And as witnessing grows and becomes integrated, you will be able to see Ram Jethmalani disappearing. Even before death, in meditation, the ego dies. The ego disappears. Once the ego has disappeared, once you have seen yourself as an egoless entity, then there is no death for you. We can say it in another way. It is the ego that creates the illusion of death. And ego itself is false. Hence, death too is false. We cling to the false, that's why we have to suffer from death. Sannyas means becoming disidentified with the body-mind mechanism, becoming a witness, a seer, a watcher on the hill. And as you become a seer, a watcher, the hill rises higher and higher, and the dark, dark valley is left behind. You go on seeing the valley for a time being, then slowly, slowly it is so distant, you can't see it. You can't hear any noise from the valley, and a moment comes at the ultimate peak of the hill that the valley exists no more for you. Then even alive, in a sense, you are dead. Ashtavakra, one of the greatest seers of this country, says, the sannyasin is one who is dead even while he is alive. But the person who is dead while he is alive will be alive when he is dead. You also ask me, I want to be really convinced that death is eternal sleep. Ram, convictions can't help much. Because conviction means somebody else silencing your doubts, repressing your doubts. Somebody else becoming authority for you. Maybe logically he is more argumentative. Maybe he is a great rational mind. He can convince you that there is no death. And you may be silenced and your doubts may be silenced. But even the doubts that have been silenced will come back again sooner or later. Because they have not disappeared. They have only been repressed by logical arguments. Convictions don't help much. Doubts persist. as an undercurrent. One is a convinced Christian, another is a convinced Hindu. And I have seen all kinds of people are all full of doubts they are. All of them, Christians, Hindus, Mohammedans. In fact, the more a person is full of doubt, the more he claims stubbornness, the more he tries to believe, because those doubts are painful. He says that I strongly believe in the Gita, in the Quran, in the Bible, that I am a staunch Catholic. Why you need to be a staunch Catholic? For what? You must be suffering from great doubts. If you don't have any doubts, you don't have any beliefs either. Doubts are the diseases and beliefs are medicines. But all beliefs are allopathic medicines. They repress. They are all poisons. All beliefs are poisonous. Yes, for the time being, they can give you a feeling that now there is no problem. But soon, the doubts will assert. They will wait for their right time. They will explode with great urgency one day. They will erupt like a volcano. They will take revenge. Because you have repressed them, they have gathered too much energy through your repression. One day, in some weak moment, when you are off guard, they will take the revenge. Your so-called saints are all suffering from great doubts. No, I cannot give you any conviction. And I don't trust convictions, beliefs. But Ram, I can invite you to come along with me. I can help you to see. Why be convinced? There is no need. I have seen. And I can help you to see. And only your own seeing is going to be of any value. I have realized, I can help you to realize. I have traveled the path. I can take your hand in my hands. I can take you slowly, slowly to the highest peak of meditative experience. Your own experience will be a real transformation. Then doubts can never come back again. And when you have known, you will be surprised. All the poets that have been telling you that is sleep, deep sleep, eternal sleep, that's what death is, have been telling you lies, consoling lies, beautiful lies, helpful lies, but lies are lies. And the help can only be momentary. It is like you are too much worried, too much tense, and you take to alcohol. Yes, for few hours you will forget all your worries and all your tensions. But the alcohol cannot take your worries away forever. It cannot solve them. And while you are drowned in alcohol, those worries are growing, becoming stronger. You are giving them time to grow. And when you will be back next morning with the hangover and the headache added to the worries, you will be surprised they are bigger than you had left them. Then it becomes a pattern of life. Become again and again intoxicated so you can forget. But again and again you have to face your life. This is not an intelligent way to live truly. I am against all intoxicants, against all drugs. They don't help. They only help you to postpone problems. I would like really to solve your problems. I have solved mine. And the problems are the same, more or less. I can bring you closer to me so you can feel my heart and you can see through my eyes and you can feel what has happened, and that feeling, that taste will become a magnetic pull on you. It is not a conviction. It is not a belief. It creates trust. And once the trust is created, the journey has started. I know, Ram, you need great help. I have seen into your eyes just once. You have been here, and just once I have looked into your eyes. They look very sad. You must be carrying great anguish inside yourself. On the outside you are a successful man, the topmost criminal advocate of this country. On the outside, you are successful in every way. A member of the parliament, president of the Lawyers Association of India. But deep down, I have looked just a passing glimpse that you are sitting on a volcano. Great anguish I have seen in your eyes. Great tears waiting just to flow down from your eyes. You are not in any way blissful. I can make you blissful. Why ask for convictions? I can give you the real experience. My whole effort here is not to give beliefs to people, but experiences. not to help them superficially, but really to transform them. I am absolutely available to you. And you cannot escape me for long. Ram is also my advocate. And he enjoys telling people that I am God's advocate. But to be my advocate is to be in danger. Sooner or later, you will be trapped. Maybe that's why I have chosen you as my advocate, so that you can come closer to me. My ways are devious. A great love has arisen in you for me. Now that love is the first flower of the spring. Much more is on the way. But remember, my whole approach is that of existential experience. I don't want you to be believers. I would like you to experience on your own. I don't want to convince you. What I am saying is my experience, that there is no death. I am not saying to you, believe that there is no death. I am simply expressing, sharing my experience that there is no death. It is a challenge. It is not an effort to convince you. It is a challenge to come and explore. You are welcome. Think of me as your home. The second question. Bhagwan, I have felt a deep sadness all day long, stemming from your remarks today about psychoanalysis and recalling your jokes over the years about psychiatrists. In my own life, I have been blessed with encountering a few rare and wise psychiatrists, psychologists, one of whom led me to you. These people provided and continue to provide an oasis for me in an otherwise barren desert in the West. It is not so much their profession as the level of their being that attracts me. Why do you hit this profession so hard? And how can I trust myself and my experience when it conflicts with what you say? I feel caught in a paradox. Prem Sarjana, I hit people only when I love them. I don't waste my hits on unnecessary people, on unworthy people. Psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, psychologists are my targets. I am throwing my net to catch hold of as many as possible. It is said of Jesus, one day early morning, he came to the lake. Two brothers both fishermen were throwing their nets into the lake to catch fish. Jesus puts his hand on one of the brothers. He looks back, looks into those eyes of Jesus, which are far deeper than the lake, far more silent than the lake, and far more beautiful. He understands only the lake. His whole life he has been working on the lake, fishing. Looking into the eyes of Jesus for the first time, he becomes aware that this is possible, that eyes can be so beautiful and can have such depth and such clarity and such blueness and such vastness. He is immensely attracted. He is a simple fisherman. And Jesus says to him, "Enough is enough. You have been catching fish your whole life. Now come and follow me. I will teach you the art how to catch men." And the fisherman followed Jesus, became one of his apostles. I'm interested, immensely interested, in catching all kinds of psychologists, psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, for the simple reason that they have the greatest potential. They can become the right soil for the new man to arrive. They are free of all religious nonsense. They are free from all political stupidity. They are the freest men anyway. Now there is only one thing left with them, a thin barrier. They have made psychoanalysis their religion. They have created their own trinity, Freud, Adler, Jung. They have created their own Bible, their own theology. Now they are caught in it. It happens. When you have lived for centuries into prisons, even if you are allowed freedom, you will soon enter into another prison, because that has become your habit. You cannot live without chains. They have broken all the chains, but they have now created new chains of their own making. And when you make your own chains, handmade, homemade, you are more attached to them. Who bothers what Buddha said? 25 centuries have passed. Who cares what Jesus said or not? In fact, they have receded so far away that nobody is really obsessed with them, except few people who are not contemporaries, who are still living 20 centuries back. But when you create your own chains and your own prisons, and psychoanalysis is the latest religion, it It is very easy to fall a victim to psychoanalysis, to Sigmund Freud, than to Jesus Christ. It is easy to believe in Marx than in Muhammad, than in Mahavira, than in Manu, than in Moses. Because he is so close to us, he speaks such a contemporary language. And that's what has happened to the communists. Kremlin has become their Kaaba, their Kasi, their Kailas. They have also their own trinity, Mars, angels, Lenin. They have their own Bible, Das Kapital. They have their own apostles, Stalin, Mao, Castro, Tito. And the same is happening to psychoanalysis. It has become a new religion. I hate psychoanalyst Sarjana because I love them. I am really interested in them. I would like them to come and experience me and to come and to know what is happening here. And many have heard the call. Out of all the professions, psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, psychologists, have received me more deeply, more profoundly. Hundreds of them have come and become sannyasins. And certainly I go on joking about them. Those jokes are also my love affair. That's how I saw my love, my interest. You say, I have felt a deep sadness all day long, stemming from your remarks today about psychoanalysis and recalling your jokes over the years about psychiatrists. You seem to have yourself made a religion out of psychoanalysis. That's why you feel sad. Otherwise you would have enjoyed the jokes. You would have loved them. They are so true. Psychiatrists are crazy people. I mean beautiful people. Whenever I say that somebody is crazy, I am appreciating. You have to learn my language. Whenever I say that somebody is crazy, I mean that somebody is valuable. To be normal is not a very great thing. To be normal is to be average. That is a condemnation, that somebody is just normal. That means he has nothing in him, just hollow. Don't feel sad. I am not against psychoanalysis. Although I would like psychoanalysis to go beyond it, it has to be a stepping stone. And whenever I see somebody clinging to a stepping stone, I hit him hard to say him, to show him that there is something beyond. And you say, in my own life I have been blessed with encountering a few rare and wise psychiatrists, psychologists, one of whom led me to you. You may have met, there are a few people who are really intelligent. Knowledgeable, but you don't understand the meaning of the word wisdom. It is impossible to find a wise psychoanalyst. If he is wise, he would have already become a sannyasin. He will not be a psychoanalyst anymore. And they can be of great help. And particularly in the West, where masters don't exist, psychoanalyst is the only possibility of gaining any help. A poor substitute for a master. Because the master means one who is enlightened, one who has arrived, one who has no more any problems to solve, any desires to be fulfilled, one who is already fulfilled. It is very difficult to find a master in the West. The next best is the psychiatrist, the psychoanalyst. But remember, he is only the next best. And when I say it is difficult to find masters in the West, I mean that the Western tradition has fallen into the hands of the priests. For 2,000 years the priests have not allowed masters to survive, to exist. Or even if, in spite of them, a person became enlightened, he had to go in hiding. He could not declare his enlightenment. He could not share his enlightenment. Or he had to share it in such a way that the priests don't become aware what he is doing. So two things Western enlightened people have been doing. One was pretending to be part of the church, using the language of the church and pouring their enlightenment into it. Because that was one of the ways not to get into conflict with the church and the state. That's what was done by Mr. Eckhart. St. Francis, Jacob Bohme, and others. They remained part of the church. It was just a device to survive and to share something. And they used the language of the church, which is very unfitting. They could not be so free as Zen masters or Sufi masters. They could not express themselves totally. They have to force their experience into Christian jargon, which was dull, dead. Or those who were not ready to compromise, they had to go in hiding. They had to become underground. That's how alchemy was born. Alchemists were not chemists. Alchemists were not really trying to transform base metals into gold. That was just a device to hide behind. The alchemists were real masters. But they pretended to be alchemists. And if you had seen them from the outside, you would have seen them concerned with base metals and gold and silver and many, many experiments were going on. But deep inside, the real experiment was going on, transforming unconsciousness into consciousness. That is real transformation of base metal into gold. Gold represents consciousness, enlightenment. So this happened in the West. The priests were so powerful. And the priests were in such a conspiracy with the state that either they burnt people like John of Arc, who was a mystic. They killed many mystics. Or they forced mystics to go underground. Or they forced them to speak the language of the church. Hence in the West, masters almost disappeared. And now from the East, particularly from India, there are many, many so-called masters roaming all over the West. Mahesh Yogi, Muktananda, etc., etc. I call them etc. Nandas. These are all pseudo people. Because the master waits for the disciple to come to him. There is no need for the master to go anywhere. If he has real magnetism, he will attract people from the farthest corner of the world. If you don't have any magnetism in you, then you have to go and sell whatever you can sell to foolish people. So now the whole West is full of these pseudo-masters. It is better, Sarjana, to be with a psychiatrist than to be with a Muktananda. Because the psychiatrist is at least moving in the right direction. He has not arrived yet, but he is moving in the right direction. You can find few very intelligent people in that profession. But wisdom is totally different. Wisdom means enlightenment. Wisdom means one who has known himself. But I can understand your difficulty being in the desert of the West, an oasis becomes of tremendous importance. And that's why you become very sad if I hit psychoanalysts. But without hitting them, it is impossible to wake them up. I can understand your difficulty. But now that you are here, part of a Buddha field, you should get rid of your psychoanalysts and psychiatrists. Say goodbye to them. Thank them for all that they have done to you. But say goodbye to them. In the West, you were helpless. And that was the only possibility to get any help. It was deep in the woods back yonder, begin old Herbie, the guide. I was plodding along, minding my own business, when suddenly a huge bear sneaked up behind me. He pinned my arms to my sides and started to squeeze the breath out of me. My gun fell out of my hands. First thing you know, the bear had stooped down, picked up the gun, and was pressing it against my back. "What did you do?" gasped the tenderfoot. Old Herbie sighed. "What could I do? I married his daughter." In the West, what else can you do? Helpless. But now that you are here, don't feel sad if I hit psychoanalysts. You say that it is not so much their profession as the level of their being that attracts me. You don't know what you are saying. What level of being you are talking about? I have seen hundreds of psychoanalysts. The commune is full of them. We have more psychiatrists than psychiatric patients. What level of being? There are not many levels of being in the first place, only there are two planes. Either you are enlightened or you are unenlightened. Do you think that there are many, many planes, that a man is 10% enlightened, another is 20% enlightened, another is 30% enlightened? No, either it is 100% or it is zero. 0% or 100%. You must have been attracted. That much I can understand. But your attraction is more because of you than of the level of the person to whom you become attracted. The West is suffering from many mental illnesses. It is good to suffer from mental illnesses than to suffer from physical. It is at least something higher. It is better to be rich and frustrated than to be poor and starving. I have known both poverty and richness. And to be frank with you, I must say, to be rich is better. Because the rich person suffers from rich illnesses. The poor person suffers from poor illnesses. The poor person is concerned with the body. The rich person is concerned with the mind. And the psychiatrist, the psychoanalyst can provide you many consolations, many adjustments. And certainly, when you are disturbed, anybody who looks undisturbed, who looks very wise in his advice, who goes on analyzing your dreams, looks that he has a different level of being. It is not so. All that psychoanalysis is doing is helping people to be adjusted. The Western modern mind has become very maladjusted. It is a good sign, because it is a sign of a crisis, the identity crisis. All the old values have become invalid. New values are needed. The past has become irrelevant. We have succeeded so much in the West that we cannot live with the values which were created when people were poor. Remember it. A poor society needs different values. A rich society needs different values. When a poor society succeeds in becoming rich, it becomes maladjusted, because it goes on teaching the old values which are no more relevant. And it lives in the new society which is rich. So people's mind are in a mess. What has been told to them by the priest and by the school and the college and the university belongs to the past. And the society has moved from there. It is as if you are taught the mechanism of a bullock cart, and you have a car. Now you will be maladjusted, because you know the mechanism of a bullock cart, and you have a Mercedes Benz. Now you are at a loss. Your knowledge is irrelevant. But you cling to your knowledge, because that is all that you know. That's what is happening. People were told for centuries to be ambitious, to have all kinds of riches, to succeed in the world. Now it has all happened. Now to tell to people to be rich, to be successful, is utterly futile. They will laugh at you. They will say, what nonsense you are talking about. Hence the hippies. In the East, they cannot happen. Old values are still relevant. People know about bullock carts and people have bullock carts. They fit perfectly well. The Western technology, the Western science, the Western affluence has gone far ahead than the Western mind and mind attitudes. So everybody is at a loss. His knowledge does not fit with the situation he lives in. He cannot drop the knowledge, because dropping the knowledge he becomes almost ignorant, and there is no other knowledge available. The function of the psychiatrist is to help these maladjusted people to become adjusted again. This is not a very revolutionary work. It is anti-revolutionary. It is reactionary. That's why I hit on psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis has to herald the new age. And on the contrary, what it is doing is helping people to become adjusted to the old rotten society, which is dying. Psychoanalysis has to help people to the new man which is soon to arrive on the horizon. That's my effort here. My work is multidimensional. It is not only religious. It is not only educational. It is not only psychological. It is not only artistic. It has all the dimensions, because the new man will be a multidimensional man. And psychoanalysis is helping the old rotten society to survive more than it can survive without the help of psychoanalysis. Priests, rabbis and ministers often face anxieties, fears and frustrations. This was the case with Father Flanagan. The demands of his parish overwhelmed him. He feared lest he might face a complete mental breakdown. So he consulted a psychiatrist. The doctor encouraged him to lay aside his ecclesiastical vestments, then don civilian clothes, red tie, striped shirt, overalls, and go out to a tavern and mingle with common people who frequent such places. There, incognito, he might readily overcome his frustrations. He accepted the prescription, changed his garments, and made his first trip to the tavern. As he sat at a table, a go-go girl came tripping up to him to take his order. Said she, "Have I not seen you before? Your face looks familiar." A bit embarrassed, he answered, "No, indeed, you have never seen me before. This is the first time I have ever been in this tavern." Finding the treatment encouraging, he returned to the tavern a second time. The same go-go girl rushed over to him to take his order. This time she said, "I am sure that I have seen you someplace." More embarrassed, but still convinced that he was unrecognized, he exclaimed, "Of course, you have never seen me before. This is only the second time I have ever come to this tavern." Sometime later, he visited the tavern for the third time. Immediately, the little go-go girl ran to him with a big smile, saying, "Now I know who you are. You are Father Flanagan from the church on Dublin Street." The shock of this recognition almost floored him. But the little girl tapped him on the shoulder, and with these sympathetic assurances, "Don't fret, Father Flanagan. I am Sister Elizabeth." from Saint Teresa Convent, I go to the same psychiatrist. The old ideas about life, the old morality, the old ideas of sin and repentance, all have become irrelevant. The old priesthood is absolutely maladjusted. And the people who live according to old religious ideas are feeling out of place. And the new people are also feeling out of place. Hence the gap between the generations. It has never been so big as it is today. The parents can't understand the children can't understand the parents. They speak different languages. There is no communication. A China wall has come between parents and children. All the old cherished values, cherished for centuries and centuries, look stupid. Things that we have thought are spiritual are no more spiritual. The world needs a new spirituality and a new kind of religiousness. I hate psychiatrists, psychoanalysts more than any other profession for the simple reason that they are the ones who can understand what I am doing here. And if they understand rightly, they will serve the future and not the past. They will help you to become more harmonious with yourself than becoming adjusted to an ill society which is just on its deathbed. That is where my work differs. I don't help you to become adjusted to the society. This society is bound to die. It is doomed to die. And sooner it happens, the better. Because it has become ugly. To go on carrying this rotten corpse does not allow people to live rightly. They have to take care of the corpse which stinks. And there are so many corpses in your house that there is no space for you to live. We have to get rid of the past. Up to now, neither Freudian, nor Adlerian, nor Jungian psychology has been of any help. It has become part of the establishment. Just as priests have been doing in the past, now psychoanalysts are doing the same. Helping people to compromise with the society. Helping people to be normal. Normality is not health. Health is very rebellious. And psychoanalysis is yet not courageous enough to be rebellious. Hence I hit, because I know the potential. It can become rebellious. Once psychoanalysis becomes rebellious, it will help the new man to arrive sooner. It will help the first real revolution in the world. Up to now, all the revolutions were very tiny, pseudo, superficial. Because the real revolution can only happen in the psyche of man, not in the social structure or the economic structure. A real revolution has nothing to do with the politics. It has something to do with the spirituality of man. We have to create a new spirituality, a new vision. You say, Sarjana, that in my own life I have been blessed with encountering a few rare and wise psychiatrists, psychologists, one of whom led me to you. But where he is? Now this is your duty to lead him to me. Pay him in the same coin. What he is doing there? He should be here. He must have read. He must have heard about me. But that is not the way to know me. The only way to know me is to be a sannyasin. Is to be part of my energy field. To vibrate with me. To pulsate with me. To synchronize with me. Now this is your duty. You owe this to him. Help him to come here. He may be afraid himself to come. Just the other day, I received a letter from Hari Chetna from Germany that on the radio a very famous psychologist was asked by a woman that her son has gone to Pune and it is now 6 years and there seems to be no possibility that he will ever be back. What do you say about it? And the famous doctor said that I have heard much about Pune. I have read also. You need not be worried. Your son is in the right place. But hearing about me and reading about me, while I am alive here, and the distance between Berlin and Pune is nothing. Within hours you can be here. He has never come here. These people know only one way of becoming acquainted with anything, and that is reading, studying. These people are knowledgeable people, but not wise. We are helpless. We cannot do anything about Buddha. We have to read him. Because he is no more present. But how many times reading Buddha and his beautiful sutras, the idea has not arisen in millions of hours? How fortunate it would have been if we were alive in the times of Buddha. Our reading the beautiful words of Jesus, has not the idea occurred to you that how tremendously blessed were those people who followed Jesus while he was alive, walked with him, talked with him, dined with him, wined with him? Reading about Krishna Have you not heard the distant call of his flute? Have you not felt a little sad that now there is no possibility to encounter this beautiful man? But when Buddhas are alive, you don't use that opportunity. You may have been alive when Jesus was there. He may have passed through your village and you may not have gone to see him. You may have been alive while Buddha walked on the earth and you may not have ever encountered him. You may have been alive while Krishna was playing on his flute and few courageous people were dancing around him. And you may have passed and you may have thought that these people are crazy and this man has hypnotized them by his music. And you would have thought yourself very sane. But now you cry and weep and you feel sad. Sarjana, help your psychiatrists, your psychoanalysts to come here. Tell them a Buddha is alive. A Christ is back on the earth. Tell them. And this is not only a message for Sarjana. This is for you all. Jesus says, go on the housetops and shout so that people can hear. I say to you also, shout from the housetops. Help as many people as you can to come here. Because right now, the water is available. The water is flowing. It can quench the thirst of millions. But they will have to come to the river. And they will have to bow down to the river. Only then they can receive the gifts. Don't feel sad. Feel happy that you are here. And I am going to hit again and again. So you have to become accustomed of my ways. I hit only people when I see great potential in them. The third question. Bhagwan, I am obsessed with food. I eat too much and have gained enormous weight. Can you help me to reduce my weight? Sangito, this is strange. Coming from California just to reduce your weight to me. In California there are far more facilities available to reduce the weight. I know it. Because I had to send Mullah Nasruddin to California. The same was the problem. When Mullah Nasruddin reached California, he was directed by our sannyasins there to this ultimate weight losing program. It took 4 days and was guaranteed to take 50 pounds off or your money refunded. He entered the building and was told to enter the first door to his left and to undress there. He did so, and then from a second door in the room entered a beautiful blonde woman, naked, but for a sign around her neck, it read, "If you catch me, you can make love to me." Nasruddin felt the passion rise within him. The room was fairly small, but the lady was agile, and it took him 20 minutes to catch her. After his lovemaking, Nasruddin soured and left, eagerly awaiting the next day. On the second day, he was directed to another room, a bit larger than the first. There a beautiful redhead, naked except for the sign, greeted him. The chase lasted for almost 40 minutes. On the third day, it was another larger room and a beautiful brunette. After almost an hour, he caught her too. Throughout the 3 days, Nasruddin had kept an account of his weight loss, 28 pounds to date. On the fourth day, he envisioned perhaps a bevy of beauties. He was directed to the top floor. He climbed the stairs, removed his clothes and waited. There was a click behind him as the door was locked, and out of his left eye he caught sight of a huge gorilla coming his way with a sign around its neck which read, "If I catch you, I am going to make love to you." Sangeeto, you need not come from California to Pune. But one thing is certain, people become obsessed with food only when they lose the capacity to love. It is an indication that you have forgotten the language of love. If you are in love, you never become obsessed with food. Obsession with food is a symptom that you don't know how to love. How it happens has to be understood. The first acquaintance of the child with the world is the mother's breast. That is his first introduction to the world, his entry into the world. His first relationship is with the breast of the mother. And the breast becomes the symbol for him of two things, food and love. Whenever the mother is loving, the breast is available. And whenever the mother is unloving, the breast is not available. Food and love become associated. A deep conditioned reflex happens. It becomes so unconsciously rooted that you repeat it your whole life. If the child knows that the mother loves him, he will not drink too much. Because he knows, he is secure. Whenever he needs, the mother and her breast will be available. If the child is insecure and feels that next time the mother may be available, may not be available, she will start drinking too much, eating too much. Now you can see the point. Whenever love is there, there is security and a kind of fulfillment. And the child never becomes obsessed with food. If there is not love, there is insecurity, fear, and a kind of emptiness. And the child stuffs that emptiness with food. In the West, weight is becoming more and more a problem, for the simple reason that mothers are not ready to give their breast to their children. Of course, the breast loses its shape. And the fear that the breasts will lose their shape and the woman will look old has gripped the minds of the women in the West so deeply that they are afraid to give their breast to the child, and they are creating an obsession about food in the child unknowingly, unconsciously. The child will become obsessed with food. He will eat too much. Eating will become his substitute for love. Sangeeto, you will have to learn love. There is no other way to reduce your weight. All other programs can help you a little bit, but sooner or later you will gain your weight again, because the basic root cause remains the same. You can diet, you can run, swim, you can exercise, but how long you can diet? Sooner or later you will be fed up with dieting, and your mind will become more and more obsessed with eating. Now you will eat in your fancy, in your dreams, and the mind will convince you that this is not the right way to live. You can't eat this, you can't eat that. And somehow, if you ask the doctors, all the good things have to be avoided. A child was asking his mother that, "You say God is very wise, I don't believe." The mother said, "But why you don't believe?" He said, "If he was wise, he would have put more vitamins in ice cream." He puts vitamins in things which are uneatable. And things which are really worth eating are dangerous. How long you will avoid ice cream? The temptation will be such, it will be unavoidable. So you can lose weight for a few days, and then you will eat too much. You will take revenge, and you may gain more weight than you had lost by dieting. This is the pattern of millions of people, particularly in the West. In the East, people are starving. You can see few fat people in Bombay, in Delhi, in Calcutta, but that's all. If you go to the real India, the 80% people of India are starving. There is no question of gaining more weight. They don't have enough weight. They are suffering from malnutrition. Yes, sometimes you will find villagers with big bellies and thin bodies, because they are eating food which is not nourishing, unbalanced, and they eat only when it is available. So when it is available, they eat too much. There are millions of people in India who eat only once a day because they can't afford to eat twice. So to keep their body together for 24 hours, they eat anything whatsoever is available. Sometimes the roots of the trees they have to eat. So the problem is not in the East, the problem is in the West, where enough food is available. And people have completely forgotten that food grows on trees. Children know that food grows in the freezes. You go to the freeze any time and the food is available. I have heard about a woman who must have been suffering like Sangeeto. She went to his psychiatrist and asked him his advice what to do. He pondered over the problem and gave her a picture, naked picture, of such an ugly fat woman, disgusting, nauseating, sickening. Just to see it is enough to be afraid of food. And he told the woman that you stick it inside your freeze. So whenever you will open your freeze, you will see this picture. This will remind you what is going to happen to you. So she sticks the naked picture of the woman. The psychiatrist has also given her another picture of a beautiful young woman with a very proportionate body. A world beauty. And has told, stick this too. So you can compare. If you don't eat too much, you will be like this woman. If you eat too much, you will be like that. Immediately from the next day, the woman starts losing weight. But a miracle happens. His husband starts gaining weight. The woman is puzzled. He said, what is the matter? He said, since you have put that beautiful naked woman inside, I go again and again to see the picture. And when I see the picture, I see the food too. And the flavor and the smell. And I say, why not take a cake or ice cream or something? So I am eating too much because of your pictures. In the West, the child grows with the idea as if food somehow miraculously is produced by the freeze. And it is always available, 24 hours available. Anytime he can go and he can eat. And mothers have taken their breasts away. And mothers are not much available either. The husbands go to the work and the mothers go to so many committees they belong to. Liberation movement and conscious raising committees. And they have so many charity shows going on, and they have to sell the tickets and collect the charity and funds. They are not available. The father is gone, the mother is gone. The child is left with the freeze and with no love. Sangeeto, just understand the root cause of it. Love is missing somewhere in your life. I will not take your obsession with food as a real problem. It is a symptom. Love is the real problem. Love more. And if you love more, you will be loved more. And it is not yet late. You can find a woman, and all women are mothers, and all men are always like children. So any woman will do, because she will function like the mother. And each man needs a mother. His whole life, he needs mothering. And each woman needs children. Even the husband is only the eldest child, that's all. And if you cannot find, you can come to me. I have always many applications with me. Women searching for men, men searching for women. And I fix anybody with anybody. I don't believe in astrology. I believe only in accidents. Mullah Nasruddin awoke one morning and looked at the clock. It was 5 minutes to 5. Unable to go back to his sleep, he went to the front door to get his newspaper. On the front page he saw the date, May 5th. Fifth day, fifth month, 5 minutes before 5, he thought, today will be my lucky day. He decided to go to the horse races. So he got dressed and went to the corner to wait for the bus. Soon it came. It had the number 5. And Nasruddin noticed when he boarded that there were 3 passengers, the driver and himself, 5 in all. He arrived at the track and waited for the 5th race. He bet 500 rupees on number 5 to win. His horse came in 5th. Enough for today.